Today is Wednesday, December 2nd, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the UK approves a vaccine for COVID-19.
Help is on its way with this vaccine, and we can now say that with certainty rather than with all the caveats that that I normally have to put around that.
Also ahead, Hong Kong jails three prominent pro-democracy activists.
And the sentence is for organizing and inciting others to join a protest that took place last July.
Plus, New Zealand declares a climate emergency. These stories and more are next. Our top story is in Britain, where there has been a major development today in the fight against COVID-19. The UK's Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, or MHRA, today issued emergency approval for the use of a COVID-19 vaccine made by U.S. company Pfizer and German company BioNTech. The vaccine should begin reaching the most vulnerable people in the UK early next week. Here's MHRA Chief Dr. Julie Raine speaking at a news conference in London earlier today.
The way in which the MHRA has worked is equivalent to all international standards. It's been done using a process known as a rolling review. A rolling review can be used to complete the assessment of a promising medicine or a vaccine in a situation where time is of the essence, in the shortest time possible. But, and this is a very important point indeed, that doesn't mean that any corners have been cut, none at all. The public can be absolutely confident that every rigorous check has been done to reach the judgment that we reached, that the benefits far outweigh any risk, that the safety of the vaccine has been scrutinised independently by our Commission on Human Medicines, and no stone has been left unturned. So absolute confidence in the safety, effectiveness and quality of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine.
The UK has had Europe's deadliest COVID-19 outbreak with over 59,000 deaths. Health Secretary Matt Hancock, speaking on the BBC, said several millions of people will receive the vaccine in the UK this month.
I'm just so pleased that, you know, 2020 has been just awful, and 2021 is going to be better. And help is on its way. Help is on its way with this vaccine. And we can now say that with certainty rather than with all the caveats that that I normally have to put around that. This will take time to roll out. You've got to have that 21 days in between the jabs anyway, and we've got to get this rolled out at the speed at which it could be manufactured. But I'm confident now, with the news today, that from spring, from Easter onwards, things are going to be better.
Still, the speed at which approval was given has drawn criticism from the European Union's regulatory body. The European Medicines Agency said that its longer procedure to approve vaccines was more appropriate, as it was based on more evidence and required more checks than the emergency procedure chosen by Britain. The EU said it would make a decision on the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine by December 29th. To understand a bit more about what the UK's approval of this vaccine means for the fight against COVID-19, I reached out to Dr. Mark Lipsitch, epidemiology professor at Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Massachusetts. Dr. Lipsitch, thank you for joining us. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. First, can you explain what does this approval mean for the fight against COVID-19 in Britain?
Well, I think it's an important step, and it's what we hope will be able to happen in many countries around the world in short order. And it's great that the UK regulators found that the data were sufficiently compelling, because, of course, most of us haven't seen the data. We've just seen the press release. So it's encouraging that a thoughtful, careful regulatory agency has given its stamp of approval.
And let's look at the approval process. Do you have any concerns about how quickly this was approved?
My understanding from press accounts is that the reason for the faster approval in Britain than elsewhere was that the agency was just much more involved and devoted much more attention to the approval process and got asked a lot of questions and got a lot of information along the way. So I think approvals take time partly because there are competing priorities, and it sounds from what I've understood so far as if the reason that this one was quicker is because it was a choice to make it quicker by devoting more resources. So that's not, the data should not change once they are produced. So letting them age doesn't have any intrinsic benefit. It's just how quickly you can make a careful decision.
And now let's look at next steps. For this to be effective, what do you think needs to happen in terms of distributing this vaccine?
Well, it has to be rolled out and gotten to the public. I mean, there's, as they say, vaccines don't save people's lives. Vaccination does. So it has to be delivered to people. That's challenging because of the cold chain for this particular vaccine, the requirement for deep freezers. But that's a solvable problem and with enough resources. And I think in the UK, as elsewhere, there is going to be the issue of vaccine confidence because it's a new vaccine and because anti-vaccine groups have been active all over the world, including in the UK. And so there will be a need to instill appropriate levels of confidence in the vaccine. And then, of course, there are also some important uncertainties about how the vaccine works. We don't really know yet whether it will protect people against getting infected. Well, we only know that it prevents them from getting sick. And so the effect on transmission and infection is a really important piece, because the more of that there is from this vaccine and other vaccines, the more effective it will be at the population level in reducing transmission.
You mentioned people who may be skeptical. What would you say to people who aren't sure about the safety of this particular vaccine?
I think the key point is that all of us start out skeptical, and the question is whether data resolve that skepticism or whether the skepticism is just fixed. And the scientific approach and the best approach for the public in general is to say, I want to see evidence that this vaccine is safe and effective, and to rely on a range of experts to help them interpret that evidence, because it's complicated. But people should ask questions and then be influenced by the answers. And so far, we haven't seen the data publicly, but the regulators in the UK have, and they've examined it and determined that it's safe and effective. And that's the first step. And it's perfectly reasonable to ask questions about a process that's novel, about a vaccine that's novel, and about a disease that's novel. At the end of the day, people need to decide whether they want to risk the vaccine, which very well might make them feel ill for a day or two. It has done that in the trials to many people, or whether they want to risk the infection, which can be much worse than that.
You've mentioned a couple times that the data for this vaccine is not publicly available. Is that normal?
Regulatory bodies always have access to more data than is publicly released in papers, just because they need much more detail than comes out in scientific papers. Usually there's a scientific set of scientific papers supporting the safety and efficacy, and that started to happen. Some of the safety data is out in peer-reviewed literature, but the full efficacy data isn't. It is a little unusual for it to move this quickly, in the sense that usually the paper is out before the vaccine is approved.
And is that a concern for you, or is that just another, you know, unique aspect of this unique response to this unique virus?
I trust that the regulators are interpreting the data carefully and with an appropriate degree of skepticism. And I think that it would be better to be able to see it, but that should be happening probably before there are any significant number of vaccine doses available, would be my guess.
That's Dr. Mark Lipsitch, epidemiology professor at Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Massachusetts. Dr. Lipsitch, thank you for joining us.
Sure. Bye-bye.
The world's largest COVID-19 outbreak is in the United States, with over 270,000 deaths, including an average of over 1,500 deaths a day for the past week. The virus largely hits urban areas in the U.S. first, but the latest and largest surge of cases is now devastating the rural parts of America. For more, VOA's Mariama Diallo has this report.
The U.S. is now averaging more than 170,000 new cases a day. This is affecting not only large hospitals in cities, but also smaller ones like Scotland County Hospital in rural Missouri. Chief Nurse Elizabeth Guffey says they are seeing a 30% positivity rate.
That's one in three patients tested is testing positive. Our increase in hospitalizations is definitely there. Over the last 2 to 3 weeks, we've definitely seen at least half of our patients in the emergency room have been known COVID positive prior to walking through our doors.
People come to the 25-bed hospital from six surrounding counties to be treated for farm and sports injuries, chest pains, and the flu. Usually, there is plenty of room. Not now. The small hospital with roughly six doctors and 75 nurses among 142 full-time staff is in crisis.
Staffing has been the biggest challenge. You still have all the other things that happen in regular life in addition to now COVID, and we have the majority of our staff are young mothers. So if your kid gets sent home or quarantined or schools go on virtual learning or all of those other situations also affect our ability to bring in staff every day.
Nurses are working extra shifts to cover hospital needs, says Guffey.
Right now we are tapped and maxed out at our resources, and it's very difficult to incur even more patients every day.
Out of more than 13.5 million coronavirus cases in the U.S., the state of Missouri has over 306,000 confirmed cases and over 3,800 deaths, according to a tally by Johns Hopkins University. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
This is VOA. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has rejected a bill approved yesterday by Parliament that would have suspended UN inspections and boosted uranium enrichment. Rouhani said the bill was harmful to diplomatic efforts aimed at restoring the country's 2015 nuclear deal and easing U.S. sanctions. The bill gained momentum after the killing of a prominent Iranian nuclear scientist last week. Rouhani is a relative moderate in Iran compared with more hardline lawmakers who dominate parliament and favor a more confrontational approach to the West. China says its spacecraft sent to bring lunar rocks back to Earth has collected its first samples, adding to a string of successes for Beijing's space program. The Chinese space agency says the Chang'e 5 probe touched down after descending from an orbiter. The lander will spend about 2 days drilling into the lunar surface. Two women were missing after a boat carrying dozens of people sank off the island of Lesvos today, a Greek Coast Guard official said. The official told Reuters that 32 people were rescued and a search operation was underway with the assistance of two helicopters and a vessel from the European Union border agency Frontex. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Authorities in Hong Kong today jailed three prominent pro-democracy activists. One of them, Joshua Wong, received more than 13 months in prison. The sentence is one of the toughest of an opposition figure this year. For more, I reached out to journalist Rhea Mogul in Hong Kong. Rhea, thank you for joining us.
Oh, no problem.
Rhea, can you first explain what happened in court today in Hong Kong?
Sure. So today, a Hong Kong court has given a sentence to three pro-democracy activists, most prominent Joshua Wong, Agnes Chow, and Ivan Lam. And the sentence is for organizing and inciting others to join a protest that took place last July during Hong Kong's anti-government protests. Now, this is not a sentencing under the city's new sweeping national security laws. Joshua Wong has been given a sentence of 13 and a half months. This will be his third time to enter prison in his entire life. Agnes Chow has been given a sentence of 10 months. This will be her first time. Then Ivan Lam has been given a 7-month sentence. So that's what we know so far. They have been denied bail and they were taken straight to the prison from the court this evening in Hong Kong.
So what exactly did the court convict them of doing? I guess, what is it that they did?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question, definitely. So the case centers around perhaps one of the most striking scenes from the early days of the protests last year in Hong Kong. So hundreds of thousands of protesters swamped the area outside police headquarters in one of the central districts in Hong Kong. And what's interesting is that last year's anti-government protests were a leaderless movement. There was no one person that sat at the helm of the entire almost 11-month movement. So people online have expressed their outrage that Joshua Wong, Agnes Chow, and Ivan Lam have been sentenced for organizing this protest when essentially it was just sort of this leaderless, very kind of organic gathering. The prosecution, however, of course, positioned the three of them as the leaders of the protest, in particular painted Wong as the leader of the protest because he gave a speech that night in front of all of the thousands of protesters, and he urged them to, you know, stay put and besiege the police headquarters.
Now, Hong Kong has had a lot more freedoms than mainland China, and as you said, this was not under Hong Kong's new national security law. So, you know, protesting, gathering in large numbers, speaking out, was that actually against the law in Hong Kong?
Well, that, again, is an interesting question. I suppose there's a gray area when it comes to that. It was definitely not illegal to gather and protest in Hong Kong. Hong Kong was the only place on Chinese soil that every year held a vigil to commemorate, for instance, the Tiananmen Square massacre that occurred, and thousands of people would gather to do that. However, the protest last year in question that was brought up in court today was not an authorized gathering. So that essentially means that a letter of no objection was not issued to a particular group for people to be able to gather. So essentially it was an illegal gathering, but protests prior to the national security law were not illegal, provided that they had a letter of no objection from the police.
And what's the reaction been to these sentences, both in Hong Kong and internationally?
So in Hong Kong, of course, many Hong Kongers have taken to social media to express their frustration, their anger over what they see as an unfair sentence. There's been a lot of talk, you know, about how young all three of these activists are. Joshua Wong turned 24 years old in October. Agnes Chow, she's 23. It's in fact her birthday this coming Friday. People have expressed their sadness that she's going to spend her birthday in prison. And Ivan Lam is only 26 years old. So what's pretty outstanding is just this youth. You know, they're all so young, and people have been expressing just they're upset that this is what's happening to a lot of Hong Kong youth. And internationally, there has been some statements that have been put out by foreign ministers and leaders of other countries. For instance, the British Foreign Secretary urged authorities to bring an end to what he characterized as a campaign to stifle opposition here in Hong Kong. And Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, she also put out a statement on Twitter and social media to express her upset over today's sentencing.
That's journalist Rhea Mogul in Hong Kong. Rhea, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
In the U.S., court documents unsealed in a federal court show that the Justice Department is investigating a possible crime related to funneling money to the White House in exchange for a presidential pardon. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
U.S. District Judge Beryl Howell on Tuesday released a heavily redacted order that described what she called a bribery for pardon investigation. Federal prosecutors in Washington said they had obtained evidence of the scheme in which someone would offer a substantial political contribution in exchange for a presidential pardon. About half of the 18-page document was blacked out, with the publicly available version providing few details of the alleged scheme and naming none of the people potentially involved. In August, Howell granted a Justice Department request to view emails between a lawyer and clients, saying attorney-client privilege did not apply, but did not identify who was involved. Government investigators said they had seized over 50 digital media devices, iPhones, iPads, laptops, and memory drives. A Justice Department spokeswoman did not immediately respond to requests for comment, but a department official said Tuesday that no U.S. government official is the subject or target of the investigation. The U.S. Constitution grants presidents leeway to pardon people convicted of federal crimes. Last week, President Donald Trump pardoned his former national security adviser, Michael Flynn. That was the first of what is expected to be a string of pardons in Trump's final weeks in the White House.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. In Australia, fire crews are battling massive bushfires on Fraser Island, the world's largest sand island, which have been burning for 6 weeks, forcing tourists to flee the island off the country's northeast coast. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Australia's Fraser Island is a World Heritage Site just off the northeast coast and the planet's largest sand island. And for 6 weeks, massive fires have ravaged its low brush and rainforest amid the region's first major heat wave of the year. The devastating bushfire began at a campsite on a remote part of the island, state emergency officials told local media. And state fire officials say that since Saturday, more than 1 million liters of water and fire-taming gel have been dropped. So far, it has razed nearly half the island, also known by its indigenous name, Kugari. In a statement issued on Wednesday, the state's emergency services warned tourists that they may need to evacuate, adding, quote, "conditions remain unpredictable and can change rapidly." According to local media reports, several guests have been ferried away from the island as conditions worsened. Total fire bans have been enforced in several parts of the northeast amid bushfire season, which runs from late spring through the summer. Last summer's season, called Black Summer by Australia's Prime Minister, razed more than 37 million acres of bushland, killed 33 people, and billions of native animals.
Thanks to Brian Wood of Reuters for that report. And next door to Australia, New Zealand promised its public sector would become carbon neutral by 2025 as it declared a climate emergency on Wednesday. It's a symbolic move that critics said needed to be backed with greater actions to reduce emissions. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the motion was based on United Nations research showing carbon emissions need to reach zero by 2050 to avoid a 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in temperature, a threshold many experts say is crucial to protecting ecosystems.
As a government, we are also announcing the Carbon Neutral Government Program that requires government organisations to be carbon neutral by 2025. We must get our own house in order. How can we stand and take a leadership position amongst the private sector unless we take the same action that we expect of them?
The motion was passed in Parliament and met with applause. The program will require government agencies to measure and publicly report carbon emissions and offset any they cannot cut by 2025. In her speech, Ardern also argued this motion was vital to avoid human displacement, exhausting global resources, and protect future generations.
This declaration is an acknowledgement of the next generation, an acknowledgement of the burden that they will carry if we do not get this right and if we do not take action now.
New Zealand joins 32 other countries, including Canada, France and Britain, all of which have declared a climate emergency.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters, and that's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. For the next 2 days, Steve Miller will be hosting this show, and I'll be back on Monday. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.